So you know, each week we have to start by just listening a little bit.
When wilt thou save the people, O God of mercy, when?
You can sing if you know
not
it.
Not kings and lords, but nations. Not thrones and crowns, but men. Flowers of thy heart, O God, are they? Let them not pass like weeds away. Their heritage, a sunless day. God save the people. Shall crime bring crime forever? Strength aiding still the strong. Is it thy will, O Father, that man shall toil for wrong? Oh, no, say thy mountains, no, say thy skies. Man's cloudy sun shall brightly rise, and songs be heard instead of sighs. God save the people.
How many are familiar with that song? Just a few of you. So it emerged from the, it's a show tune from the musical Godspell. And that was originally in the 70s. It was made into a movie as well. And then this is the remade version. And I think one of you will know, 2012, 2013? Some of you who are 13? Yeah. Somewhere around there. just a couple of years ago, they did a remake. And the idea is the story. It's the story of the teachings of Jesus retold in kind of a bit of a hippie style originally, but enacted throughout this ragtag group of disciples. And one of the songs is about crying out for God to bring rescue, because it just seems like people are just destroying each other. And it echoes Psalm 94, which says, "How long, Lord, will the wicked, how long will the wicked be jubilant? They pour out arrogant words. All the evildoers are full of boasting. They crush your people, Lord. They oppress your inheritance. They slay the widow and the foreigner. They murder the fatherless. They say the Lord does not see. The God of Jacob takes no notice." And we see this attitude. I don't know if you've ever felt like that, where you've looked around at the world and you said, "Really, God? Like, how long? How long will pain pierce our lives? How long will loss pull at me? How long will tragedy seem like it's always on the forefront of my mind? How long will hatred seem to be the most powerful force in the world? How long?" Sometimes we're not even sure what we're hoping for, because our world can be cruel. And so, what do we do with that? Well, the response to that prayer that's deep within us, that we see within the Psalms, the response to the prayer of the song that I just played, that's kind of where we end up with today. We've been going through the book of Revelation, which is the first time we've done it ever, and I did it with a great amount of fear and trembling, and I cannot wait to sleep this afternoon. Because these 3 weeks have been more full of study, or these last 5 weeks, more full of study than I think my seminary time was that I just finished. And there's just this wormhole. Revelation is so difficult to understand. It's terrifying to people. People say, we look at it, and we've talked about this, you know, in the past 2 weeks. And I will say that if you really want to kind of get into this and you haven't, you can listen back to the first 2 weeks, because I'm not going to recap all of that, but we went through a lot of content on our journey through the main themes. But people are terrified of this book, that it looks like Jesus of the Gospels turns around and just becomes not Jesus of the Gospels in many ways. And so the question that we looked at the first week is that true? And so the big main points that we looked at 2 weeks ago was that the good news that reveals the surprising Jesus is this: the Old Testament messianic fulfillment. Lion, this lion that would come, that all the Jewish people thought was going to bring political, radical, military victory of Israel, actually is embodied in Jesus and is the Lamb. So there's this moment at the beginning of the book of Revelation where John hears that there is only one person worthy to open the scroll, and the scroll kind of reveals how God will set things right. And he hears that it's going to be a lion, and he turns around, and what he sees is a Lamb. And the image there is the central image of the entire book of Revelation, and the point is that the lamb is still the lion, but that God's methods are powerful like a lion, but they look like a lamb, because God's methods now and forever are always the self-giving sacrificial nature that is embodied in the sacrificial lamb. God dies for his enemies rather than destroys them. Okay, so that's the overarching image. And so the cosmic Jesus is still the crucified Jesus. He's still the same that he was, and he conquers with self-sacrifice. So all of the violent imagery that we get within the book of Revelation, and there is plenty of it, when Jesus does battle, the sword is coming out of his mouth. It's the battle, it's the power of Jesus' words to separate and reveal the heart. That's what the battle is. Jesus speaks with power. He doesn't go out and mow people down. Okay, and so the way that the army of the Lamb conquers is by overcoming in the same way as their commander-in-chief. So throughout the book of Revelation, the people of God do battle against evil, but they do battle against evil by being faithful witnesses and even dying, if that's what's necessary in order to reveal the heart of God, which is completely radical. And if you read it on first glimpse, you're not going to get there. You have to understand Hebrew apocalyptic literature, but you can listen to what we talked about the last 2 weeks. And then catching us up to last week. Last week we talked about the beasts and all of these crazy images and what it meant in first century, to the first century church that John was writing to. And the beasts represented political domination and militarism and religion, where the political order is identified with the divine, where the leader of the nation begins to claim authority that is not his or hers to wield. And so what we end up with, as well as the economic networks of human exploitation, that's what's represented in these beasts and what's called Babylon over and over again. It's the nations of the past that used power and the powers that are represented, and it's the current and the future. Anytime that power is drawn and worship in its own way is drawn to something outside of Jesus, it takes a beastly form. So we talked about what faithfulness looks like in the book of Revelation last week, because that's the challenge. Will God's people be faithful? And it looked like naming false peace. So when there's a lack of violence, but it's because of oppression, God's people speak out. It means praying boldly. Prayer in Revelation 8 shakes the foundations of the earth. This is radical. This is a different way of doing battle. We change the world, not by fighting in the world's methods, but by praying boldly and maintaining faithful witness. We reject violence and power as a means of change. And we reject our trust in and love of money as the most powerful force in the world, which most of us subtly end up pledging our allegiance to. Okay? So that catches us up to this week. So this week, we answer the question, how, Lord, will evil continue forever? And so we're going to talk about hope. And in order to talk about hope, we have to talk about the fact that there's all this judgment in Revelation between chapters 6 and 20. And we're really uncomfortable talking about judgment. But several things should make us pause before we run away from everything in the scriptures that mention judgment, because there's plenty of judgment that's mentioned, okay? One thing that's important to keep in mind is that when we think about judgment, we often think of what we call retributive justice or retributive judgment, and that's like getting back at someone. So someone wronged you, so justice means I'm going to punish them. I'm going to lock them up, whatever. Justice in the scriptures that is linked with the same word as judgment is restorative. And so what that means is that God's heart is to make things right. Not just to punish the wrong, but to make things right. Now, if you've been on the side of doing wrong over and over, when God makes it right for the people who have been wronged, it's not going to be good news for you. But the storyline is that that's what the emphasis is. And so that's one element that we need to understand before we dive into judgment. The second one is that we are not the judge. We never were. I don't know, Christians at some point got that confused. That we can actually trust God. I mean, if we trust God, then we can trust God to figure things out. And God's people have never been the ones who are expected to enact and execute justice or judgment in the world. We are called to be a witness to the truth of God and the almighty constant invitation to come toward the way of God in the world. But we are not called. In fact, Jesus, when there's this parable about weeds and wheat growing up together that Jesus tells, and people are like, let's separate them now. And Jesus says, hold off. You might get confused. You might rip out the wrong thing. It's not your job. One day I'll sort things out, and you can trust me. And that's a part of this, is that Jesus is actually the judge throughout scriptures. Jesus is the one who can look at things truthfully and honestly. And when we realize that Jesus is the judge, then we understand how Jesus treats his enemies in the scriptures. As he dies, says, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." Jesus is a trustworthy judge. He's not going to screw this up. Okay? So it's very, very important for us to understand that the reason that we're often so afraid to talk about this stuff is because maybe we've seen people who they understand Christian faith completely through the lens of judgment. And so that's just how they look at the world. Like, all you bad people are going to get what's coming to you. And that's like the message. It's not good news at all. It can't even be construed to be good news. So what ends up happening is people become known for that, and then we want to stay so far away. But what if we looked at judgment through a different lens? What if we understood what was actually being spoken of here? I said, "God, when will you come and rescue? Because there is so much pain in the world. And we long for God to make things right." What if we had the assurance that one day that actually would happen? That God would truly make things right? That's where we're going to get to. So, interestingly, since we know this is apocalyptic literature, and since we know that this is written to oppressed and persecuted people who were incredibly discouraged, beyond discouraged, we've talked about that every week, these messages of God judging evil actually ends up bringing people tremendous hope. And it should for us as well. So when God brings judgment, we ought to be thinking, the people who are listening to this have had family members murdered. They have been told that they have to run from their land. And the message that they are getting is, don't worry though, it's not going to last forever. And there will come a day where this is not a part of your reality. Just begin to think about the hope that that can actually bring. So, there are three series of judgments in the book of Revelation. They start in chapter 6 and kind of go all the way through chapter 20. There are sets of seven, and there's seven seals, and then there's seven trumpets, and then there's seven bowls that get poured out. And then there's little interludes between all these things. And so the first thing, and we're going to kind of breeze through this, but each of them, some people think that what they mean is a literal transpiring of events. First the seals, then the trumpets, and then the bowls. But the interesting thing is that the way that they're written, they emerge from each other. They're like nesting dolls. So out of the seventh trumpet comes the seventh bowl, and out of the seventh seal comes the seventh trumpet, and the seven bowls come out of the seventh trumpet. It's really kind of confusing. But the main point is that they all end with the exact same wrap-up of God making things right. So they're actually intended to be seen as a story of the reality of time between when Jesus is resurrected and the reality of earth until the time that Jesus comes and makes things right again, okay? And so it's not all future, but it involves some of that. And that's how it's meant to be read. And so they're all a telling of these three stories from different perspectives. So in the seals, the first thing that's released is the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You've heard about this, right? I just had a picture out there. There we go. You know, so this is what happens. And the first four seals, it's these four, and what they are is they are kind of images of conquest and images of death and images of violence and images of famine, okay? Unfortunately, they are essentially an average day on the earth, okay? The world, interestingly, lest we think that this is specifically intended to be that God is making war or sending war. Here's an interesting aside. When we talk about judgment, and we often think, well, is it God's judgment or is it like what we might call natural judgment? And that's not a necessary question. So much of the way that God has built us to relate to one another, there is natural judgment when we don't do that. When we begin killing each other, people die. This is natural judgment. That's not God doing it. It's saying that when you don't live according to the way of Jesus, you will find that there is destruction that always follows in its path. Okay? So anyways, what happens is, I just want to point out one thing, and some of this stuff's going to be on the screen and some of it's not. But in chapter 6, he heard these voices are sent out with each opening of the seal. And when the second seal came out, another horseman was a fiery red one, and this rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. Tim was given a lot. He represents the violence of the world. But this is a really interesting one. Then the black horse comes out. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice saying among the four living creatures, That's the eyes that look on the world. A quart of wheat for a day's wages and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages is what it starts out. Those are hunger rations for a family. You would die from not having enough of that. For that much would kill a family. A quart of wheat for a day's wages and 3 quarts of barley, but do not damage the oil and the wine. But the luxury still stays. Do you understand that the image there is this people, that there is an oppressed group, there is enough, because there is wine and there is oil, and that is being enjoyed by some, and then others are dying because they don't have enough. This is the reality of famine in the world. This is the reality of human-inflicted evil that is represented by this release. And we know that because the fifth seal that breaks open is God's people who have died crying out. So God's not releasing these things, not this time. And so they are released from the seals, but what, remember, we're getting a revealing. That's what Revelation is. It's a revealing of the way that things are and what God's going to do about it. And so these images are these powers that destroy the earth, and then there's an earthquake, and so there's natural disasters that are a part of it too. And the whole world is trembling and shaking, and they're in fear because they understand that God is being revealed in a new way, and they say, who can stand? And here's where we start to get the hope. They say, who can stand? It's the last verse of chapter 6, I believe. Make sure I'm right. I don't want to ever tell you wrong information. Yep. And so then here's what we get in the next moment, all right? Let's get up to here. And then we'll... So in the next moment, he turns. And after this, I saw four... This is who can stand? The world is literally in chaos and falling apart. And I looked and I saw four angels holding the earth, the corners of the earth back. You can see an ancient worldview in the midst of this. And then I saw another one having the seal of the living God. And here's what he says. He says, don't harm the land or the seas or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of God. Remember, that means we're changing the minds. A seal on the forehead was a mark of a mind that has been turned toward Jesus, okay? And so what he says is, I'm going to seal these people. And then he hears 144,000 from the tribes of Israel. That's from Numbers 1. That's a reference. Remember, all these Old Testament references. 12,000 from each tribe. Boom, 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 boom. But then he looks. And remember the surprise of John when he heard about the lion and he looked and saw a lamb? This is surprise number 2, okay? So he hears 144,000 and it's the tribes of Judah getting ready for a battle. And he turns and he looks. And here's what we see. After this, I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, every people, every language, standing before the throne and the Lamb, and they were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out in a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And there is this worshiping community, and the point being, actually 2 points being, in this early part, there's 2 hopes. There's a hope for now, and there's a hope forever. The hope now comes in the first part of the sealing of these people. And what it represents is that even in the midst of all of the present evil in our world, we are protected in Jesus. And this is what I mean by that. We're not protected from pain. We're not protected from mistreatment. We're not protected from death even. But we are protected from the soul separating effects of evil. Even though we walk through war, even though we walk through violence, be it word, be it action, be it death, whatever, there is nothing in the world that can stop us or separate us from the love of God. That is the message in all of this fantastic imagery that's being given to God's people at this time. And we need to understand that. It's confirmed in Romans, right? Paul's writing, who can separate us from the love of Christ? And they were going through some serious soul-separating potential moments. Trouble, hardship, persecution, famine, nakedness, not having enough. Violence, being killed by the sword? No. I'm convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, or demons, or the present, or the future, or any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Okay. So the first good news is that in the midst of our world that sometimes feels completely chaotic, sometimes feels like it's falling apart, sometimes it feels like there is so much evil around us, so much selfishness, so much racism, so much wealth and greed, so much whatever you might want to say, that in the midst of that, those of us who see it and those of us who experience it, as we find connection with Jesus, we will still be well in the deepest places, even if we're killed. What kind of a promise, what kind of a hope is that? It's amazing. It's incredible. It's hard to grasp because it's so radical. But there's a second hope, and the second hope is the hope forever. And that comes from the glimpse of looking at these people of God. And the glimpse is that the worshiping community of Jesus will be bigger and broader than we can ever imagine. When John looks and he sees these people from every nation, every tribe, every tongue, and they're proclaiming the goodness of God, what we see is we see this vision of the fulfillment that was made in the promise to Abraham way early on. When God came to Abraham and said, hey, go out your tent. Unzip your tent. They didn't have zippers. But go out your tent and look up. And what do you see? And he says, I see the stars. He said, can you count them? No. He said, that's an image and a glimpse of what I'm going to do one day through this movement. Those are going to be the people that experience fully the restorative goodness of my love and of rescue. That should bring us incredible hope, because I'm not sure why people get off and get so excited on a tiny heaven. I'm not sure what power trip it is for us not to hope that Jesus continues to redeem and restore in more ways than we could ever imagine, especially because throughout the Gospels, that's what Jesus proves. He proves that nobody is beyond redemption, and he'll use any method he can to reveal love. And so we've turned that into a lot of really nice formulas, but Jesus bucks our formulas. So he refuses to allow us to make a formula. If you do this, X, Y, and Z. Sometimes he says, get up and walk. Salvation has come to this house. Sometimes he says, leave everything you had. Sometimes he waits to see someone turn and give their money to the poor. And then he says, you've been rescued. Sometimes he says, go and sin no more. Jesus doesn't play by those games because he's an actual person. And so it's about relationship with Jesus. And that invitation is over and over and over in the book of Revelation. Okay, so then the seven trumpets come. All right. This is a retelling of the story of the plagues from Exodus. All right, and here's where it gets really interesting. We're not going to go through this because we can't possibly go through 14 chapters. But there's, in these, as they are released, what we have is we have these plagues that hit the world. And each time, there is no change in how the world responds. This is the fascinating thing. There's no repentance. We know that these judgments, and remember, these are not literal, okay? You've got to remember this. These are, the way of Revelation is like political cartoons. They are meant to portray a real truth, but with fantastic imagery. So these plagues come, and it's this idea of God shaking the world. Hey, wake up, everybody. And everyone's like, no, because they're so committed to their ways of evil, okay? And so these plagues come, and when the bowls are poured out, it's a very similar reality. But here's the thing, in between those two, in the exact center of the book, John is given the scroll, and it's a small scroll right now. It's like a dream. It changes. It's so super weird. But he eats the scroll, which is the same thing that Ezekiel was told to do, which means I'm going to internalize it, and then I'm going to speak out the contents of it. And this is going to reveal God's rescuing of the world. Okay? This is in chapter 11. And here's what happens. He eats the scroll, and he's given a vision that he proclaims. And here's the vision. It's absolutely fascinating. The vision is that he sees two prophets that God will raise up, okay? And this is in chapter 11, verses 3 to 13, okay? He sees two prophets, but they're called lampstands. And lampstands in chapter 1, verse 20 means churches, okay? So, and they have the prophetic witness of both Moses and Elijah, okay? Two lampstands, this is verse 4, that stand before the Lord of the earth. If anyone tries to harm them, fire comes from their mouths and devours their enemies. Where does the fire come from? What's that mean? Power of the word, right? And so he's saying they will be able to speak words that separate evil and call it out, okay? And they're just like Moses and Elijah because of this. These men have the power to shut up the sky so there won't rain during the time that they're prophesying and turn the waters to blood and strike the earth with every kind of plague. This is imagery because we're supposed to see Moses and Elijah. That is the law and the prophets that are represented. What is the law? Here we go. Let's get whiteboarding. So the law, in New Testament understanding, is interpreted through grace, but it's a way of life. Okay? This is super important. So these churches are going to bear witness and speak truth to the world by representing Moses, which is a way of life. He brought the law down. He taught God's people how to live. And the prophets in Elijah. And the prophets spoke truth to power. Okay. And they're going to be these powerful prophets, but he's talking about the church's representation in the midst of evil. And what happens? There's a beast that comes, and the beast kills the prophets. Super let down. But 3.5 days later, God resurrects the prophets. And he doesn't just raise them, but he raises them so that they can be seen by those who oppressed. And in that moment, the foundations of the earth are shaken again, and there's destruction on the earth. Remember, destruction on the earth represents strongholds of evil falling apart and falling away. And that's the first time in the entire book of Revelation where people turn. So up until this point, all of this judgment has happened. And just like Pharaoh in the Exodus story, the world has hardened their hearts. But it's when faithful churches represent Jesus and even are killed and their message rejected, but they maintain their integrity in the way that they fulfill the way of Jesus by a way of life and by speaking honest truth to power. And it's in their dying that for the first time, people come and give glory to God. Do you understand how radical this message is? Over and over and over, it's saying, listen, there is a way of doing power that the world accepts, and there is the way of the Lamb. And the way of the Lamb is God's methods always. And even when judgment comes, people will often not turn back. But when they see the church through and empowered by God, living in such a way that they're even willing to die, God will raise them up in such a way. And that might be, it might look like metaphor in your life. Eugene Peterson says, isn't this the task of the church and the task of Christians? To willingly be killed and then resurrect every single day. To maintain their method and message of love and faithfulness in the world, even if they are pushed aside and ignored and killed, they come back and they maintain that presence, and that changes the world. So, here's what the hope now is for this, and then we get to move on beyond the judgment. The hope now is that suffering faithfully is winning, not losing. Suffering, feeling like we are working for good but never achieving it. Trying to maintain faithfulness even in the midst of despair and frustration, that's actually winning according to the book of Revelation, according to the scriptures. Unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground, Jesus says, it cannot bear fruit. We have to be willing to give of our own lives for the sake of the goodness of what God's up to. And then things change. And it's radical and it's beautiful. So, all right. That's what we see. So this amazing image, right, of the prophets dying for their enemies, dying because of their enemies, but still seeing the mercy of God, is at the exact center of the book, all right? So then in chapters 15 and 16, I'll just take you through this real quick. There's bowls of judgment there, repeating the plagues of the Exodus. Again, it all leads up to this massive battle between good and evil. We're not going to talk about the beast because we talked about that last week. Evil is defeated among the nations once and for all in the seventh bowl. It's really, really like kind of gory and all these things, but it's not in the way that we think. I'm trying to help us understand this. So here's some things to remember before we go on to the final two chapters, and this is where the meat of all of the joy and hope comes, okay? Things to remember about judgment in Revelation. The first thing, these are symbols of and not depictions of God eradicating evil, okay? Really important. This is not describing how God will eradicate evil. It is an image to a people who were oppressed and being killed that, don't worry, the time will come where God will fully eradicate evil. Everything that rips apart the earth. Okay? So they are symbols, not the tactics. Okay? The second thing, so therefore, the violent or intense battle-rich images don't negate or conflict the central image of the Lamb as the lens through which we see all of Jesus' work going. All right. The second thing is that these are detailed visions that are not actually intended for Babylon. They're intended for the church. Okay? So how we might say that is... it's like Let's say your child is getting bullied at school, okay? And you sit down with them and you say, "Bud, listen, I promise you, I know this is hard right now, but there will come a day when people see that this bully is just insecure and they won't be impressed by him anymore. And it's not going to last forever. And he's nervous and he's trying to prove himself and he has no power. And that time will come where you'll see that too. But that might not be how I engage with the bully." Do you understand? I'm talking to my son. This message is for the church who are getting ripped to shreds. And it's saying the time is coming where this will not be your story forever. Don't lose faith. Don't lose heart. Don't give up. So it's really important that we read this through the lens of the church who is suffering at this time. The third thing is that when judgment comes, then there is, it's not just systems of power. It's also, in the book of Revelation, it's also comes to those who align themselves with systems of evil and refuse to leave them behind. There are consequences there, but that's not for a lack of opportunity to join what God's up to. There over and over is clarity. In fact, even the last word of the entire Bible, the last quote of Jesus is, "Come. Come and drink freely. Anybody. Anybody." So we can rest that this is not going to be when there is the reality of God looking and seeing goodness, that there is constantly hope for every single person. But we're not going to really get into that. And then the final thing is that we need to understand before we move on, and this takes us there. The final judgments in Revelation are not the last act of history in terms of what's depicted. They are the penultimate act, not the ultimate act. The ultimate act is actually the new beginning of a new creation. So the last act of history isn't God coming in with a sledgehammer and slamming everything down, not according to Revelation. It's God eradicating evil so that something beautiful can be built forever. And this is so incredibly important, what the last word is in the scriptures. Okay? So that takes us to our hope forever. And the hope forever through this section is that in the midst of faithful perseverance, God's going to bring about a renewed heaven and earth where all suffering and sorrow are a thing of the past, and anyone is invited into this experience. The Lamb has won. And now we get the revealing of what that will look like. Again, it's not intended to be literal. If it was, as you'll find out, we'll be living in a giant cube. Because that's the size of the New Jerusalem. It's 12,000 by 12,000 by 12,000 in every direction, and it's just a big giant cube. But that's not the story. That's not what's intended to be represented. What's intended to be represented is that there will come a time that is more beautiful than anything that you could possibly imagine. And it starts by saying in chapter 21, here's what I saw. After this battle where evil and death ultimately is banished and quarantined. Death and hell are banished in the last verses of chapter 19. And so here's what happens. I'm sorry, last verse of chapter 20. In chapter 21, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first earth and first heaven had passed away. That word for new is about renewed, and Paul talks about that when he talks about creation in chapter 8, crying out for renewal that one day will come. Okay, and so there's this new heaven and new earth that comes. And there are these interesting things about what is not present. Because there's this new heaven and new earth, and then they see this city that's coming out of the sky. And the city is the new Jerusalem, but what that represents are all of God's people throughout all of time are coming, and there's going to be this beautiful new creation. Guess what's not present? Let's talk about it, because this is where it gets so incredibly beautiful. So here are some of the things that aren't present in the new creation. Let's just turn this thing around. Spin it right round. Makes me want to sing that right round song. Okay, here we go. So, no. First thing that there's none of, no more sea. Those of you beachgoers are like, what? Sea for Hebrew people represented chaos. Despite the fact that Galilee had a bunch of fishermen, Jewish people hated the sea. It was where the creatures came from in the book of Job. The sea tossed and turned. When Jesus calms the sea, it's a representative of Jesus speaking peace in the midst of chaos. It's beautiful. So there's no sea in this new place. But don't worry. That's not literal. If you want to go swimming, I believe there probably will be plenty of opportunities. So there's no sea, and it's unbelievable and gorgeous. There's no death in 21 chapter 4. There is no death left. There will never be death in this city. There's no such thing. It's unheard of. It's not around anymore. Sorry, let's see where we can get everybody else. There's no mourning or crying. Okay? There's no sadness. It's been eradicated completely. Okay? All sorrow. There's no evil in verse 8 of chapter 21. Nothing evil is left to be able to destroy the beauty of God's hope and world. I hope you're starting to take some of this in. Here's a fascinating one. What else is there none of? There's no more temple. There's no church buildings. What's that all about? Chapter 21, this is verse 22. He looks around and he says there's no more temple. Why? It's maybe the most radical statement because the temple was so important to the Jewish people. There's no temple because God's presence is so soaked in every single step of the place that it's all just an act of worship. It would be completely redundant to go to some place to be able to gather with God's people or connect with God's heart. It's all everywhere. Awesome, right? Okay, and so what else is there nothing of? There's no sun and moon. This is an interesting one. What does this represent? There's no sun and moon, and yet there's no night ever. Why? Because God is the fullness of light. So there's no sun and moon. There's no bodies that govern. This is all representative, right? Because what we're seeing is that light will be everywhere. The beauty of the sun rising in the morning and bringing light to new day, that's moment by moment by moment. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. And here's maybe one of the most radical ones. There's no more closed gates. Her gates will never be shut to this city. And that's connected because there's no night. Verse 25. There's no night. There's no need for protection. But what does a gate do? A gate protects you because it makes sure that nobody can get in. The final temple has no gates that have a shut mechanism at all. I will let you just imagine the hope that we have in an image that there is always the gate open for those who want to come. It's amazing. Oh, it's beautiful. Okay. Where are we at? Oh, what it does have. Here's a couple of things that it does have, and this is interesting because of what we've talked about. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. So we still do have civilizations. This is fascinating. This is not going back to the garden. This is the garden plus what God created people to do. It's just civilization in its most beautiful ways. People use their gifts. There's still leaders. There's still nations. There's still all of this, but it's without all of the power dynamics that oppress and crush and destroy people. And on each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And here we go. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of nations. This contradicts a theology that might say everybody and everything is wiped out completely. That's not true. There is healing that's actually happening, emanating from this city. Maybe because the doors aren't shut and more will be invited in. We don't know. We don't have to. We can just be filled with hope at this prospect. And the final other thing of the details of the city, it says it's 12,000 stadia, and that's a unit of measurement. And what that means, and it's one direction, back direction, and up direction. So it's a perfect cube. And what that is meant to represent is fullness and completion and perfection. But guess what the size is? It's about 1,500 square miles. 1,500 square miles happens to be an approximate of the entire landmass of the Roman Empire at the time. The world as John knew it. Isn't that beautiful? So this new Jerusalem, it's big enough to encapsulate the whole world as John knew it. And it's as big as the Roman Empire, which was unfathomable to people. And so it comes down, and in the midst of this is being declared, God is making his dwelling among people. Now, all of this future hope, it can lead us, and it has led Christians to do one of two things. One, we think about the future hope, but we don't read it really well, and we assume things like the Thessalonians passage that's been used to create an idea of a rapture, where God's people get ripped away, and somehow something happens down on earth without them, which is never in Revelation. There's nothing like that in Revelation. You just need to know that. that's offensive, sorry, but it's just true. There's just nothing like that in Revelation. There is this passage in Thessalonians that says, we'll be called up to the clouds and Jesus will come from the clouds. But here's the thing. All right, it's worth it. So here's the thing. What happens is that Jesus is using these images from Daniel, which there's a son of man that comes and clouds are representative of power, but he was also using a Roman metaphor. When a Roman governor or emperor would come into one of his cities, their subjects would run out to meet them halfway and usher him in to his home, to his city. He didn't live there at the time, but it was his city because it was in his empire. And that was a way of doing things. We see a similar thing happen, actually, at the processional when Jesus comes into Jerusalem on the donkey. People come out and meet him and welcome him in and usher him in. The image there is intended. Paul's intending to say, listen, one day when Jesus comes to restore all things, his people will come to greet the true emperor and bring him back to his true home, which is the earth. It's just a renewed earth. But this will be the dwelling place. This is, by the way, some of you are totally freaked out. Because most of the time we talk about loving people and discipleship and all of that. And that's really important. But to have a healthy view of what the end goal is, here's why it's so important. Because many of us have an escapist perspective, and that's what we've been given. And the escape perspective says this: the world is evil and it's beyond redemption. It also says matter is evil and we are primarily spiritual beings. Jesus is coming to rescue us from earth and take us to heaven. And it's all about the future. It's all about me getting to heaven. And therefore, salvation doesn't require discipleship. The way of Jesus only means that I just give this kind of mental assent to Jesus, and then I don't really have to follow him. But what we get in Revelation is about renewal, a new heaven and a new earth. This is also talked about in Isaiah. One day God will bring the new heavens and the new earth. God's world is good, but it's corrupted, and God is working to renew things. Both soul and body bear the image of God. From the beginning of creation, Eden tells this story. The creation is good. It's not evil. It's just been corrupted. And Jesus will come to dwell with us in wholeness on a renewed earth. It's a present focus that is in light of the future, but it gives us actual meaningful purpose in living now. So salvation and discipleship are completely connected. So last night, having no idea that this was going to hit me like it did. Have you ever seen Tomorrowland? Anybody ever seen that? You should watch this film. It's fascinating. But it's with George Clooney and a bunch of kids. So it's kind of a sci-fi thing, but the end story that all you need to know about is there are these crazy scientists, and they've created algorithms, and it's not just about weather, but they've created like the end of the world. They've foreseen the end of the world. Wars and politics and everything comes crashing down. And what they do is they project this reality into people's houses so that they might be galvanized to change things. But it backfires. And what they find that people have done is they've simply accepted it as the reality and essentially said, well, this is it. I guess that's that. They thought it would turn people into saying, I will change things, I will change the way I behave, but it required something of them, and they refused. And I think sometimes when we look at this as Christians and we talk about the future, if we think that God's just going to burn it all up and that this doesn't matter except getting to heaven, then it doesn't give us reason to live right now well. And we can just become resigned. The world is evil. That's it. But if we actually believe that the world is good and it's God's and one day God will restore everything, then it inspires us to be people who share the same character of God and to work toward that now, to work toward restoration, to care for the earth, to love people even if we're wrong, because we know that that is the nature of God and one day God's going to come and bring that in its fullness. We can't do that. We can't bring that. There will always be evil as long as we're in the world because we're responsible for a lot of that evil. But there is incredible hope in living purposefully with this understanding of God renewing all things in mind. So that's a ton of info. I'm sorry. Kind of. Because we've got 3 weeks to talk about the book of Revelation, and I now realize that it should have probably been more. But I want you to get away from your head for a moment, and I want you to get into your heart just for a little bit as we wrap here. And if it's actually helpful to close your eyes, I want to actually encourage you to do that. I want you to imagine the greatest things in your life that pull your allegiance away from Jesus and toward self, power, violence, greed? What are the things in you that you are doing battle against? And just sense them and dwell on them for a moment. And then I want you to think, what are the greatest things that break your heart as you look out on our world? What are the greatest things that break your heart personally that you've experienced? What are the greatest things that you look out and you say, God, how long will this last? How long will people treat each other like this? And I want you to imagine the reality of that gone. Anger, gone. Heartache, gone. Selfishness, gone. Hatred, gone. Poverty, gone. Greed, banished. Racism, gone. Abuse, gone. Mental illness, gone. Suffering, gone. War, gone. Neglect, gone. Insecurity, gone. Pride, gone. Let yourself, just for a second, imagine that this is true. Let yourself consider the possibility that God will one day create and recreate with your partnership a renewed earth that is completely devoid of the power of anything that could hurt it. I want us to end by just taking in some music and hearing in the midst of that, imagining the heavens and the earth coming together in God's renewed reality. And as you listen, I'm going to read a few excerpts from the book of Revelation in chapter 21 and 22. And just take it in and imagine. Let yourself imagine, because this whole book of Revelation is about imagining with hope. It's imagining the fact that what breaks our heart today will not break our heart forever. And so imagine stepping into this world of complete fullness as you hear this music, and just let it take you into this new forever reality. I could not possibly find a picture that would represent what we are talking about. So it's just color. So if it helps to see the color, then take it in. Heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Throne said, I am making everything new. To the thirsty, I will give water without cause from the spring of the water of life. City doesn't need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations will walk by its light, and kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. On no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night. God and the Lamb will be in this city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. They will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever. Say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. Let the one who is thirsty come. And let the one who wishes to take the free gift of the water of life. Amen. Come, Lord Jesus. If you want a dramatic end to the Bible, there you go. I've told you already, this is not what we normally do. We're normally talking about family relationships and learning how to forgive each other. But we need sometimes to be inspired by a new vision and to be remembered that God is not to be feared, but to be followed. And we are people of the Lamb. So we walk out and we act like it today and forever, every single day. Jesus said, don't even try to figure out when this all comes. You're missing the point if you do, he says in the book of Matthew. You're missing the point. So we are not date setters, nor do we think it'll look exactly like it says in Revelation, because it won't. But we remember that God will eventually eradicate all that pulls anything away from the beauty of a world forever soaked in God's goodness. So hopefully that is enough to give us peace and rest and joy and motivation for the task ahead.